Dr. Mark Katz, who is our clinical czar, and Dr. Frank Ehrlich, who is our administrative czar, to make sure that all of the directives that we get from the County Department of Health, the State Department of Health, directives from the CDC and NIH that we follow diligently and let you know that we are prepared. I'll turn it over to the two physicians.
Okay, you go first?
Absolutely.
This is a first. Dr. Tech is seated to me because it's always true. I'm going to leave it up to you for questions, just to let you know that 6% of the hospitals in the United States were found to be ready for the Ebola when we first sort of felt it coming. 6%. And yet, every hospital in the United States, on a daily basis, has varying degrees of infectious disease. This was different, very different, because of the high mortality of this entity. Are many more than 6% ready today? Yes. Are we all 100% ready? Not yet, but we're getting there. We're much closer, and we've implemented a whole host of policies and procedures. We've been training our staff in the use of PPE and learning how to box up specimens, take them out, get them back, what to do, how to clean rooms, how to transport patients. We're learning a lot of things. And interestingly enough, for those of you who had the foresight, if 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago now, you'd have invested in the companies that make the PPEs, you could have retired probably. It's very hard to order the equipment and get it in. We're all working on it. We're all working hard to do it, and the companies are in mass production. But as these things come about, as new guidelines come out, and for those of you who follow the state DOH questions and answers, you'll notice that almost daily there are 12 to 15 new items on there, some of which had been answered by the CDC, others had never been answered by anyone. So we are learning, and we're as prepared as I think anyone could be to handle a suspected Ebola case or a real Ebola case. We've done some construction in our ER. We've changed it around a bit. We've got an isolation room. And so I think we're as ready to go as we can be.
It's interesting that Frank said that. I just checked my email. Our last mail came at 5:06. Updated checklist with new CDC guidelines for it. So it was updated as most recently as 5:06 tonight. So every day we face the challenge of having to change what we're doing. But as Dr. Ehrlich has said, we are putting together plans, policies, and procedures. We are going through a checklist. The Commissioner of Health, the Acting Commissioner of Health, has our interim, official term.
At the state level,
has put in a regulation that line by line that every hospital in New York State has to comply with, and we are working through. I actually want to take a moment to thank Dr. Carol Smith, who you all know very well, but I have the pleasure of working with on a frequent basis, and Carol has taken a very, very active leadership role in the coordinating the efforts between the hospitals, EMS, first responders, police, urgency centers, walk-in clinics, doctor's offices, the health department, really all of these stakeholders that might face the challenge. Carol's held conference calls, and sent out memos, meetings, information, posters, phone numbers. Really, it's been an example of how we can come together as a community and work in taking community resources instead of working in silos, which we so frequently do. you know, there's a lot going on. I was trying to think of what this whole experience reminded me most of, and I was, for those of you all as old as I am, you might remember when we were in elementary school, we would have bomb drills for the Russians were going to attack.
Yeah.
And we would get under our, either get under our desks, or we would go in the hallways in between the cinder blocks and curl down between the doorways. And I guess we were, that was what we were preparing for then. We never got to experience that. I kind of feel like that's what we're doing now. We're drilling and drilling and drilling and preparing, and hopefully we will never have to use this skill and this knowledge and this equipment, but we'll be ready, as ready as we can be. I guess at that point I really would leave it to, if you have questions of us.
Quick question. Is there, Dr. Smith, so is there a coordinated effort between, you know, healthcare professionals, the county, first responders to kind of look and prepare themselves? Because a lot of the cases that happened early on, like in Texas, the person was diagnosed in the hospital. And so is there something that the county's doing that we can protect our professionals?
We're doing it every day, Carl. I want to thank Dr. Tack. Dr. Tack also serves as a chairperson for our Board of Health in Ulster County. And I've known Dr. Tack a long time, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for him and what he does for the people of Ulster County and has done for years. So you're a tremendous resource, and we really appreciate you very much. Carl, we're working really hard. What I've done is I've put together basically an email listserv of all the EMS, well, Rich Parrish, who's also here from Health Alliance, who's our EMS regional coordinator, Steve Peterson, who's our emergency services director for Ulster County, Dr. Greed is the ED director for Health Alliance, Dr. Tack, Dr. Hassett, who owns the urgent care up in Saugerty, Dr. Wyman, who owns the urgent care down here in Highland, the urgent care emergency one, Martin Company. And, you know, so what I do is on a weekly basis try to have a home conference call to discuss preparedness. Ellenville Hospital is also on the call, and see where we're at, because it is very much a situation that's evolving, and that's in fact been exaggerated. Every day we get updates. I get updates every day from the State Department of Health, from the coordinators on the state level, CDC. I get a situation report every week from the state regarding what the status is in New York State. Regarding the entire situation, how many cases we have, how many cases have come through JFK, where they're going. It's quite a comprehensive report. I email that to all the folks on the list there so they know what the New York State DOH situational update is. And any CDC PowerPoints that come out on a bullet preparedness for healthcare workers, asking them to share them with their teams. It's pretty much on a daily basis, I think, you get an email from me. And we did have a conference call with the Health Alliance, Dr. Freed, Dr. Tack, Dr. Ehrlich. They went through the commissioner's orders. Dr. Zucker sent out a commissioner's orders that all the Article 28 licensed facilities, which is the hospitals in the county, et cetera, be prepared with basically a line-by-line description of what that means. The staff at Health Alliance went through it to see what they needed to do, what they needed to get into place in a very diligent way. And, you know, I felt very gratified by that and cooperation and their willingness to be part of this. Steve Peterson gave me an update today on what the ambulance services are doing and which services would be employed if we were to get a symptomatic patient at home who had been exposed to Ebola that the health department is actively monitoring as per the mandate from New York State DOH. So it's very much an integrated kind of approach. To make sure that all the stakeholders are aware of not only all the updates and changes, but certainly if we were to have anyone come into the county that we had to monitor for 21 days, they would all know that that person is in the county and that we're actively engaged in that. Very coordinated effort. And thank you for the question.
Wasn't the original problem in Dallas was that the patient came in with a high fever and was released?
And right.
So
and
it's great to know that everything is set for when one is identified, but
we've learned lessons
positions
from
that.
Yeah, and hopefully the word is getting to all the individual providers in the county. And it's a little bit more difficult to, you know, get them on board, but certainly the walk-in care centers, the emergency rooms, the urgent care centers, which very often are an alternative to the ER, hopefully they're getting what they need to, you know, do. But Health Alliance definitely is the leader in this in terms of getting organized and getting what they need done to prepare. So
and what's important here is, and I think what possibly went wrong in Texas that we're avoiding, is having good relationships, that we have a working relationship, that we talk regularly so that we make sure that what we're doing in the hospital, what's being done in private physician offices, what's being done at the county Department of Health is connected then to DOH, to the state, connected to CDC, and we have that great relationship. So I think it works seamlessly and very supportive.
And the powers of quarantine, remember, lie with the commissioner of the committee. So if we were to get someone who needed to be monitored in their home after they were stratified for risk and not symptomatic but at risk because of being a returning healthcare worker from one of those three countries in West Africa, the power of quarantine rests with me. I issue the order, and that person then needs to, you know, be in place in their home, taking temperatures twice a day, monitored by the health department staff, et cetera. So all of that's in place.
So and the thing, just so you appreciate it, I'm sorry. Dr. Smith, Dr. Ehrlich, myself, we get paid to do these things on a day-to-day basis. Dr. Tack is taking time from his patient load to deal with the volume. So to sacrifice something is in his partner's process.
Well, perhaps I can suggest maybe a quick scenario. Michael played by Charlie say, if I just got back from West Africa, I'm not feeling well, you know, I have fever, I have diarrhea, vomiting, and I call 911. So from the time that I call 911, what would be the procedure that's taking place? Maybe Rich can weigh in on this as well.
Well, what we've done with Keith Peterson, he's incorporated into his call through. If you call in and match up the questions, flu-like symptoms, what have you, they get his additional questions now. Have you been to the country? Have you traveled in the nation? And the next question is, have you been in the Western Africa and that area? And if that's the case, then when CMS gets dispatched, they get dispatched to the patient with flu-like symptoms, PSI, body soft skills isolation, recommended. What we're working on right now is a lot of the smaller groups don't have the recommended approach. Mobile Life has stepped up their plate, and their units have the equipment. So if need be, we would back up the small volunteer agency to the career service, and then they would treat the patient, bring them into health alliance, radio to the nurse on duty on the charge, and give us a heads up. Our staff, we could identify two staff who go with this patient and have them in the process of training, et cetera. They would get is what we call level C, and it's a tie down suit and tapper, pallet, air purifier, and respirator. It looks like a beehive on a hood with outside air pressure. And then they would take the patient into our isolation chamber, and then the doctors and staff would take all the time.
Okay. Yeah, that's even a simplified version of what we have to do. It's a very complex sequence of events that occur. So along with the call that the for the potential, if you were to say that you were from West Africa, it would also trigger a call to the health department on call person and to the emergency room, and they would also dispatch law enforcement with the idea of securing the area so that if the first responding EMS crew had to take a patient out, there wouldn't be other people potentially exposed. That would trigger an alarm, a notification system at the hospital through that would bring all the necessary personnel in place, because there's a decontamination area that we have available in our emergency room. And we would have the isolation room set up. We'd have the, make sure that they were met with the appropriate staff. Security would immediately secure that entry area so that the you, if you were the patient, could be brought into that area without exposing other people, other ambulances, other personnel, other triage personnel, other patients who might be in other sections of the emergency room. There's a specific coordination of which of the staff are trained and how shifts are assigned, actually, to make sure that there's enough trained people available at any shift 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's laboratory personnel that need to be notified. There's environmental personnel that need to be notified. It's an extremely complex process that has been put in place.
And the state and the CDC will be notified.
Right. It's very interesting. The state DOH is sending what they call readiness assessment teams around to every hospital in the state. And last Friday, they were at Margaville, and I was out there during, it's nothing but a readiness assessment. It's not an inspection. There's a 14-page checklist that they go through, and they ask you just a bunch of questions. Look at your ER, look at how you're set up. And the person who was there from DOH representing EMS commented, and I found this very interesting, that a number of the volunteer providers do not want to use their radios to call in potential Ebola patients. And they're finding other ways to do it, like my personal cell phone. They do not want to use the EMS radio out of probably justifiable fear of what anyone listening to that. That's the last time I'm going to get in that ambulance. And it's again, there's a very trite saying out there that the only thing one needs to panic about with Ebola is panic. And that's just what happens when these things happen. We think we've constructed our ER so that we can keep a patient totally isolated from the rest of the ER. They go, because the decontamination room has an external door, so that a patient originally created to decontaminate patients, so they come right in from the outside. So even if a walk-in patient appeared at our registration desk and they were asked the questions and they answered yes, they'd be sent back out to go in through the decontamination door. They would not be taken through the ER to get to the same area. They go back outside and come in. And Mobile Life has committed to us that they would take that ambulance out of service until it was fresh and clean.
Okay.
Any other
questions?
Very good. Well, we appreciate sharing with us your phone. And again, that was great. If anybody has any other questions, then
I just think it's a company to know, you know, that everyone's on board and that their protocols are already in place.
I'll give you with one thought. Right now, 9 out of 10 patients in the United States who have Ebola have survived. So the survival rate here is 90%, not 30% like it is in Africa. So start with that principle. And the other principle is that more people will die this winter from flu than will ever die from Ebola in this country. to get your flu shot, because that's probably more valuable than anything else we're going to talk about tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, doctors. Okay. Greg, do you want a 2 minute? Where are we with our transition? I think that was our progress.
Can you do it in a minute and a half?
I can do it in a minute and a half. We continue to work with potential affiliate partners in conjunction with the Department of Health, because I think last time I spoke, we talked about district. The Medicaid money that's out there. Well, the two processes are starting to blend into one another, and now our ability to consolidate to a single campus and shrink the hospital to an appropriate number is tied to district awards. So now we go back into the cycle of RFA in the middle of this month for capital, and that will be granted sometime in the early part of the winter. So we do have regular calls with the Department of Health. They're very encouraged by what we're doing. They're very supportive of it. And we think we'll get through the...
Is there who you've been talking to?
Sure. Yeah, we've talked about this for a while. It's gotten quiet on a lot of the fronts. But probably the two that are most profound right now are Westchester Medical Center and St. Peter's Health Partners. And to a lesser degree, HealthQuest. We've been also talking to HealthQuest.
How do you think you're going to have a definitive answer?
There's
it has been going on for quite a while.
It has, and I think it's taken as long as it has because of the complexity of district and working with the Department of Health, because you almost have to blend the two together. So in the past, where we were working just in a straight line of affiliation, we could have gotten that completed. But once you brought in the district piece and you're talking to the same partners about both, now all of a sudden they start to come together. So now district has somewhat held it up. We're in the final stages of due diligence on the two partners and see if they want to make sure they understand us. If there are any barriers there, they want to make sure what those barriers are. And that the plan that we're contemplating, size of hospital, scope of services, financial viability, are real. I want to make sure that it's not just us saying it, but it's the partners analyzing it and agreeing with it and then going to the state and going, we're in.
Could you come back again so we could spend some time discussing it?
Sure.
It's very important trying to do it.
It's very important. It's impossible to do it in 2 minutes because it's so complex. But yeah,
I think of all the questions I ever get at anything in Kingston that has to do with the hospitals, and I keep saying the same thing, you know. And the
one thing to tell folks, I am out on the talking circuit. I've had one talk at the Y. I'm doing a second. I'm at the Rotary. I'm at the Highland Seniors Club.
I need to do a public information that is some...
So I am out in talking to groups, and public is harder because you tend to end up having debates over issues that are out of our control, if you know what I mean.
Well, that could be the answer.
No, it's a bad answer. But I am out there, so people, I'm talking to as many people as I can. But I'd be happy to come back.
Sure.
Yeah,
so
does
DOH have to approve the merger?
They do. Not only does DOH have to approve it, but potentially the Federal Trade Commission has to approve it. So working with DOH, and if we can get their support, and they believe that this is in the best interest of the community, they can help us navigate through the Federal Trade Commission's review process. That can take multiple years to get through, and that we do not want to be there. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. All right, we'll move on. Next is
Hi. I won't take too long, and instead of speaking, I thought this video would be excellent as a great tool to let you understand exactly what the tobacco-free, the marketing, the point-of-sale marketing for tobacco is all about. And this really is a great visual and to speak to that. So It's only 4 minutes.
You need to turn a light down.
Yeah, maybe the light.
One light?
Because
one
you've got...
Yeah.
Okay, so hopefully this will start playing. And I'll just put it right in the middle somewhere.
Thanks, Carl.
You're welcome.
They were wrong. The evidence consistently and coherently points to the intentional marketing of tobacco products to youth as being the cause of young people's tobacco use.
It's easy to spot the cigarettes because, like, they're right behind the clerk and there's a lot of them. To spot the cigarettes, you have to go by my house. It's very easy. Yes, you have to go away. The parent is right there behind the gas register. And, like, there's a whole bunch of them in white packs. There's, like, many rows, and they're all lined up, and there's, like, different kinds of rows, and there's cigars and cigarettes and tobacco. When I walk up to the counter, I see magazines, and I see candy and lighters, and I see cigarettes.
Well, there's on the counter, there's, like, a big picture, and it says, there's, like, 3 cents, and then it says, like, the brand of the cigarette.
It kind of shifts, like, gum, candy, that bam, they kick you with cigarette packs, like, galore, and what's remains, and just keep on staring at them, like, I just don't know why.
Publicly, tobacco companies have always said they didn't want young people using their products. Privately, they've said something different.
Young adult smokers have been a critical factor in the growth and decline of every major brand and company over the past 50 years.
The tobacco industry markets to youth, which means those under 18 years of age. Over the years, thanks to pressure from health organizations, parental groups, and concerned citizens, tobacco advertising has been curtailed. But tobacco products and marketing are still highly visible in our community, and our kids are seeing them. Today, more than 90% of tobacco marketing dollars goes into one tactic, tobacco marketing is yours. Signs, posters, displays, and promotions are all known to impact youth smoking. Just how much money do tobacco companies spend on home marketing? More than $8.5 billion every year. In New York alone, the tobacco industry spends $213.5 million annually on marketing, over $500,000 per day, and almost all of that goes to pay for tobacco marketing in stores. For one simple reason, it works.
As a marketer, you want to have your product where it's going to get the most frequency, the most number of people seeing that product. Color and design are ways that you would engage a person in something a marketer would do. And also a campaign. So maybe you're doing a promotion and you're having an offer to that consumer. So they're going to remember it. And having a location such as an end cap or a register is going to get a lot of visibility in a retail store.
Haven't noticed tobacco marketing at your local stores? That's because you're not the target.
You want your product seen as much as possible in the store. That's why being in a register is a perfect opportunity because people are standing there checking out. You not only want it in front of them, you want it at eye level. And tobacco is a great example of this. It's not only at eye level for adults, it's lower at eye level for children. You really have to ask yourself, why are they doing that?
Almost two-thirds of adolescents in the United States report seeing tobacco advertising all or most of the time when they visit convenience stores.
Young people are almost twice as likely to recall tobacco marketing. Studies have shown that tobacco advertising is more prevalent in stores located near schools and where adolescents are more likely to shop. Research shows that kids who visit convenience stores with tobacco marketing more than twice a week are more likely to start smoking. And the more stores that sell tobacco near schools, the more likely kids are to smoke. Nearly 200,000 high school youth currently use cigarettes and other tobacco products. And one-third of them will die prematurely from diseases caused by smoking. The good news? There are solutions. In stores across Canada, tobacco products must remain out of sight.
the city of San Francisco, as well as Boston and other Massachusetts communities, have banned the sale of tobacco products at drugstores and other stores with pharmacy departments. California limits the number of tobacco retailers in a given area, which reduces the number of displays that kids are exposed to. In New York State, Rochester has taken action to limit tobacco retailers near schools. New York City and Providence, Rhode Island have enacted restrictions that limit or ban tobacco promotions and couponing. These communities have taken steps to protect their children. It's time we do the same. How can we protect our kids? Learn more at tobaccofreenys.org.
Thank you.
I'd like to say a few words on this. My name is Vincent Martello. I run the Health Education Division of the Health Department. And, you know, talking about Ebola is an interesting, and there's this statistic that Dr. Tack brought up. All the Ebola fatalities in 2014, if you added them together, and worldwide there would be about 4,920 fatalities this year. On average, in the United States, 1,200 Americans die per day from smoking-related diseases. That means more Americans die in 5 days from smoking-related diseases than all the fatalities for Ebola. So, really, you know, people, when Jim Calvin, I was in Newburgh at their public hearing, and their law is much, much more stringent than this proposed law here. But Jim Calvin from the New York State Association of Convenience Store Retailers went to speak at the public hearing in Newburgh. And one of the things he said is that, you know, this is redundant. We're already in 99, retailers are already, in Ulster County, are already in about 99% compliance with the law regarding selling tobacco products to minors. This is really not about enforcement of the TUPO regulations or selling tobacco products to minors. This is about, as this video demonstrates, the $2.5 million per day that the tobacco companies spend to market their products largely through point of purchase displays, price promotions, in the stores that kids frequent much more heavily, especially in the school zones where they live. So we're really not talking here about, you know, as is the case with Newburgh, we're not talking about limiting the overall number of tobacco licenses available. We're not even talking about people in retailers in school zones not being able to get a license. We're simply saying no new tobacco licenses in those zones. Yes, there are some increased enforcement for a TUPA violations, but really, you know, we can't prohibit marketing and advertising of tobacco products, but we can reduce our children's exposure to it. And tobacco marketing is designed to recruit new smokers because their customers are literally dying off. So that's really what this is about. In the least restrictive way possible, there are no fees. Licenses can be applied for if the person sells their retail store in the school zone. The next owner can apply for a license. So it's not really restrictive, but it does cap the overall number of retailers.
And Alan, you've read through this, the local law that we're looking at. Yes. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments on
it? Well, I just have one comment, actually, and it's that we do a survey every year about how what people feel about different things with point of sale, especially with focusing on that. And 78% of all of people that we surveyed believe that there should be no tobacco retailers near schools. So I think that this is a great start, what has been proposed, and I don't know what else to say about that, except that it's in your packet that I gave you, there is a Surgeon General's report. That's a red booklet. And on page 9, it says that communities that allow tobacco to be sold near schools have a higher rate of youth smoking than those that do not. So, and that's on page 9.
Yeah, I've, of course, since last month, I've had more time to really digest exactly what this law proposes. And I've come to the conclusion that, certainly myself as a legislator, that we should do whatever we can to reduce the use of tobacco, whether you're children or whether you're adults. But in particular, our kids. I don't have a problem with the thousand, designated address. So I hope that we have some support for us.
Can I make a suggestion? We're going to discuss it to actually bring it forward. The law, we're going to discuss the law, we should bring it forward.
Yeah, are you not?
Does anyone have any questions that that we might be able to clarify for you?
I just find it hard to believe that the state will not curtail the advertising in the stores or around schools. That's where we're wrong.
Wow, she just gave me an answer.
But also the FDA is addressing that.
First Amendment?
Yeah.
If that doesn't apply to magazines anymore
or so forth. Well, advertising is prohibited on broadcast media because of FCC regulations, but factory companies can still use, most of the marketing is directed at point of purchase in the stores, display advertising, where, as the video said, it's targeted to use. They need those replacement smokers. Without them, their business goes away.
No. I was feeling just about advertising.
Well, so the resolution sets the public hearing on a local law.
The proposal has been updated quite a bit based upon the input of the committee last month. So I was working with Legislator Provenzano and TSAC. We really put something together here that addresses a lot of those concerns and will have a good impact on the county.
The committee can update the resolution and present it at the hearing.
The name of the law, I just want to make it clear, is called Tobacco Retail License Designated
and
Designated School Zones, or is it called the Ulster County Reduced Youth Exposure to Tobacco in School Zones?
Would you read that?
So that should be the title of the law.
It
needs to be titled.
You were ready. So the motion is to make the resolution and the proposed local law number 14 the same. In any language.
Right, that includes that first whereas.
Wait a second. Mr. Cannell.
Yes.
What is the executive's pleasure in calling this?
I believe we should call it the Ulster County Reduced Youth Exposure to Tobacco in School Zone Law.
Okay. Ulster County Reduced Youth Exposure to Tobacco in School Zone Law.
Well, that's the amendment.
Okay.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Sorry, I'm trying to keep it. Right, so that's on the amendment.
Yeah, I had another question. Regarding this?
Regarding which part?
As far as you had mentioned that there's not going to be any fees as far as the licensing thing. And I know that it's not mentioned that there isn't going to be a fee in the local law.
One of the changes of the local law is, you know, had a reference to potential fees in the future because of the concern that the community struck it. So it's clear that there are no fees associated with this proposal.
All right.
I have a question about this Section 8 suspension and revocation of licenses.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to a couple of retailers in my area, one that right next to Bosie's, which would be included in this. Mm-hmm. I mean, the yards away.
Yep.
And the retailer said to me that he doesn't have a problem with the law as long as it applies to everybody the same way. Now, the problem with the suspension and revocation of licenses is if you're not in this tobacco-free reduced zone,
mm-hmm.
that you get fined. But if you are in it, your license is gone forever.
If you have two violations in 2 years, okay. you would lose your license. But
now,
the same is true of regular too, but the fines and the multiple violations of the TUPA and the regular TUPA for everyone by state results in potential loss of license and potential loss of your lottery license in addition to that. So it's really,
so
this is really just cost.
And it works hand in hand.
Yes.
Right. But the state doesn't have a law with regards to exposure
to near
school.
It does not. And what this law does is it caps the amount of retail establishments that we'll have within the houses of that school.
And before that, that's great. Let's just stop it right now. Okay,
and then with contracting, that's the Newburgh Law. The Newburgh Law seeks to eliminate those retailers that are within 1,000 feet of school. Ours does not go that far.
And it's $215,000.
Correct.
I'm just going to speak out loud because it's one thing that I feel that happens when you have two different penalties, you know, for two different situations, is that it's going to be much easier for the health department to send somebody in there to try to, you know, to buy a pack of cigarettes, underage kid, and then to revoke their license forever.
We check every retailer in the county.
I just don't want to, you know, target it that that's the only thing. I know we have
a group
that goes around twice a year, and they go to all the establishments.
Mm-hmm. But that won't change.
Well, what do I tell a retailer that his punishment is going to be much more severe than somebody who's 1,001 feet away?
Well, what?
Fire an attorney? Sorry.
I mean, one of the things you can tell them is that we'd be more than willing to come in and do a training.
Is this legal? Absolutely ironclad legal, where the county's not going to get sued because now all of a sudden we're favoring one business over another that both sells, you know, nasty things, cigarettes, cigars, tobacco.
So that if you're within the school district, it's none of our topics.
We would be willing to come in and do a training for any retailer.
And
we
built that
staff.
Yeah,
we built that into the penalty to help them understand and really.
Yeah, I'm going to answer the question of the retailer because he felt like that as long as it applied to everybody across the board the same, that he was okay with it. So I don't think
you're going to
be okay with it.
Yeah. And again, as I mentioned, there are 21 establishments within 1,000 feet of a school based upon the mapping we've done with the planning department. And again, I don't even think our records show the violation within those 21 within the last couple of years. So.
No, the compliance is as I said earlier, is 99, roughly 99% throughout the county, which is excellent.
So we're really reducing exposure here, if you haven't anything.
Okay. All right, good. So, what was the question?
Mr. Chairman, if I just comment too, I think it's the last item on the agenda before the folks from the tobacco coalition leave. I wanted to make sure they're aware of Legislator Provenzano. She certainly is quick to act. I was telling her about a complaint we had received from an employee last week about one of their colleagues with an electronic cigarette at the next cubicle over. And I mentioned that point, I was so impressed with that Jeanette had a proposal for law in the packet to deal with that situation. So, Jeanette, I want to really thank you for your leadership on that. So, I literally mentioned the complaint, and within an hour, she had a law drafted to fix it. So I thought that was just terrific.
That segue, I want to make a motion to open up for discussion on Resolution 4. We agree that the discussion is in the public hearing.
Thank you. This is my way of letting them, what do you know that she did? Number 400 into the bag.
Motion for discussion.
So these electronic cigarettes, they have nicotine in them? I thought it was just like vapor.
Liquid nicotine has resulted in a number of poisoning of children. This liquid nicotine is being sold in bubblegum flavor. Some various other things, again, to attract the children to it. But if you were to consume that liquid that goes into those electronic devices, it's potentially released. Well, it has resulted in poisoning for children.
Now, what's the research?
I checked and did some, in 2014, the American Heart Association agreed, they released a statement in which they argued that electronic cigarettes have not been demonstrated to be safe and that they should be regulated as medicines or tobacco products. Mm-hmm. And also the American Medical Association, they endorsed measures aimed at preventing marketing of the electronic cigarettes to minors. In the January 2014, the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease released a statement that said that they strongly support regulations of electronic cigarettes, preferable as medicine.
It's not allowing it to.
And in fact, they believe that if a young person has never smoked and starts using this electronic smoking device, they could very well get addicted to it. So all this resolution that I put in does
We already have a ban against smoking. Gosh, I forgot what was the distance.
Entire property.
I just want to add, just, you can have people come into work sitting at their desk with an electronic smoking device, and that's what the complaint was.
People are actually smoking indoors?
Yes.
At their desk?
Yes. Inhaling
at their desk.
Yeah. So let's just add this to what we already have.
I would be interested, and I'd like to do my due diligence on the effects that it may have on the people, because it is vapor, right? It's not.
There are FDA research that I looked up that there are toxins in the vapor and other heavy metals and other, you know, not just.
Has anyone done an analysis of those vapors?
There's an FDA study that is
just.
So it would be nice to have for a public hearing. Sure.
I've had a lot of
documentation. Right. Would this hearing be the same night as the other local law?
Maybe we'll see.
Wednesday, 17th. Okay, so maybe you could bring some of that.
PM, and this one is scheduled for 6:15 p.m. So it'll be 15 minutes later.
Yeah, I'll get one.
More questions.
Okay.
I want to make a motion to remove resolution 441 into discussion.
Before we do that, can I we didn't get a second yet, but Mr. Chairman, the time is allotted for us. We've got like 8 minutes. Is there any chance that maybe is it legally that we can adjourn at 7 and then come back and finish our job?
I think that if we kind of stay on track here, we'll try to see. I think so. Unless there is any.
Well, can we let's do 396 because we're kind of getting all
over the place. I picked out the motions that are 100% federal funding. We need to do it.
And I don't believe that there's anything new here that the community hasn't seen from prior years.
So
the
396
is this is actually a certification that was required in the state sales tax law, Chapter 2 of the laws of 2014. Our sales tax renewal had a specific section that required that the county certify that it has taken over the safety net cost as part of its 2015 budget. This language is mandated verbatim in that law, so the resolution conforms perfectly to that law. Procedurally, you'll pass this. You'll also pass a resolution reauthorizing the additional 1% sales tax from January 1st of 15 to November 30th.
Continue.
I was jumping the gun on you.
Essentially, I would ask if we could drop all of them, and with the exception of the one for the BMG group, which we've had contracted, and we actually passed, if I'm wrong, I don't know, that 428, we passed actually the school bus contract, I believe it was last month, or it was in September, am I right, Mr. Canal?
September, I think, yeah.
What these people do is they coordinate the school buses that are required for the pre-event preschool and early intervention. Mm-hmm. We've had the loan of benefits of doing this for 3 years, that's why I've seen all the contracts. We've had this contract consistently. That one's kind of different than the rest of the contracts. Essentially, all the rest of the contracts deal with the children and families, early intervention where possible, people ranging from having mental illness, to severe mental illness, substance abuse, basically providing shelter, involved in the shelter, a very shelter case management, providing beds. I've read all of them. I have some questions for Susie, but I don't think any of them will prevent anything from changing, from passing them. If, you know, providing beds, it's just, I'll tell you, it's very intense. These people are severe needs. The only question I do have, Mr. Connell, perhaps you can help me. There's one with the family with stock. They put Evolve in one of the contracts. The Evolve contract was separate. Do you know why they did that this year?
I believe that they did. The state grant funding changed this year.
Okay.
I can have to clarify that, but I believe that's what changed.
Okay, because it's like almost like a garbage pail of all bunch of different things for families with stock crammed into one.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that the Evolve program was included in it. But other than that, it's just...
Yeah, these represent the core of the core of our state mandated responsibilities that we contract out on an annual basis. There's nothing new here for the committee.
Yeah.
I'm going to get up a quick conversation about it.
I'm going to get on my phone.